Before I start with the experiencing and knowing, there are a couple of little items I thought you might be interested in that really probably should have been read yesterday. And on the idea of philosophy, I picked out this item, which puts philosophy in a little bit more liberal light. And so I'll just read it without comment. It hasn't really entered into the index yet anyway. It's a new one. It's a brand new one. Philosophy is the queen of every science, the empress of them all. She is born out of the absolute and unconditioned, out of the infinite cosmos, the unending process and eventuation, coeval with the mind of man. Philosophy must have an aim, an object to pursue, a purpose to be increasingly fulfilled, and she must have a method in her pursuit, a method to which her object will yield. The primary purpose of philosophy is the consciousness of self, with its corollary conception of environment and of interaction between as the experiencing of events, and of interactions and transformations among the events of environment as constituting a veritable and definitely distinguishable objective world. The method of philosophy is to participate conceptually, imaginatively, not merely physically or factually, in the events that constitute the objective and environing world. Finite and limited in his merely physical nature and powers, in his capacity for experience, man is yet ever growing. Therein lies his kinship in the cosmos. But in his conceptual capacity, he is not thus confined. He can conceive events not only immediately as they occur, but also retrospectively of the past and in prospect of events to come. There is not only a factual and objective order of events, there is also for man a conceptual order. The order of nature as experienced objectively by man is wholly quantitatively. And he breaks off there. Well, now this leaves plenty of room for philosophy to develop according to any man's thinking about it and relating himself into where he happens to find himself when he wakes up and says, I am and that is, I suppose. And this other little item, I was talking to Dan Whiteside about what Spencer Heath meant by poetry. Since a great deal of what Spencer Heath is dealing with requires poetry to really express it. Since semantic precision is limited, or it is limiting, he just simply says, poetry suggests where prose tells in grammatically correct sentences. Poetry suggests where prose tells in grammatically correct sentences.
Some of his poetry here, though, is in grammatically correct sentences.
Appreciate it. I'm going to add a couple of items, too, to the program which Spencer handed out yesterday, because I think that whether I get to read all of these or not, and I won't, I'd like to call your attention to them should you have a chance to bury yourself in some of these items. I'm going to start out with a new item, and I'm going to read it, the philosophy of science, because that is the term Spencer Heath preferred to use. And this is item 683.
Are you putting this in general philosophy or experience?
No, this is not an experiencing and knowing, because it's by way of explaining a difference in semantics between myself and Spencer Heath, I suppose, and sometimes I don't conform. I'm on my own trajectory, apparently. And I like the word epistemology right now because it has to do with what knowing and experiencing is about. And Spencer Heath thought of epistemology as a purely speculative exercise, and he said, to hell with it. I might get around to reading a sort of a negative statement that he had to make about epistemology. So what I mean by epistemology, he generally means by the philosophy of science, where you get down to the brass tacks of identifying the the nature and method of knowing and experiencing. So far we've only defined the world of it and the ingredients that make up such inquiries.
What was the number again?
683. The most remarkable thing about Spencer Heath's approach to experiencing and knowing was the simplification of the problem into a very coherent concept of reality, that is, in terms of events, quantities of action, to be technical about it, a quantity which combines in a threefold unity, mass, motion, and time. But by all means, time, because in physics, this has been one of the bugaboos of physics up to now, is we deal with energy as a unifying principle, and energy is incapable of dealing with the time element. Now, there was a time during the early course of the Newtonian Revolution when we had a very difficult time dealing with the spatial coordinates of the physical phenomena. Newton started out where the using force and momentum as unifying quantities, and the mechanical problem was exceedingly difficult to handle. It was very complicated. You solve the problem once for the forces, and again for the positions. Then, shortly afterwards, after Newton's momentum had caught on, a French mathematician by the name of Lagrange discovered that the problems of mechanics were greatly simplified if you worked in terms of energies and you solved the problem only once, and the rest of it, the spatial and the dynamical quantities simply dropped out of the procedure. So Lagrange gets credit for a great new revolution in physics, which was more properly an extension of the Newtonian one, for having simplified the problems of mechanics by using energy as the unifying concept. In working with the Heath papers and finding that Spencer Heath depends upon action, the energy combined with the quantity of time, where energy combines mass and motion, that we already know, but in combining it to a third order of complexity in abstractions to action, he has taken a higher level of unifying criteria in dealing with physical reality. It turns out that this is precisely what Lagrange had to do to discover the energy unification. I didn't understand what Lagrange had done, but I know he got credit for a great deal, and he deserved it. Lagrangian mechanics is the salvation of the mechanical part of physics nowadays. But what Lagrange actually did was to prove what Spencer Heath is talking about, that action is really the fundamental principle in physics. And very little has been done with this. The other aspect of it that makes it look pregnant is that Planck, who discovered the quantum theory, which is part of the 20th century revolution in physics, the idea that there is a minimum chunk of action lower than which can't enter into objective experience. Now, Planck refused to believe the wisdom of this himself for a long time, but this is the only way he could explain radiation. It's the only way he could explain the nature of radiation being emitted from some body containing some internal energy, some heat. He didn't like to believe this because it ran counter to the... There were two things that ran counter. The energy idea was supreme in those days, and that something as novel as action should be more superior was quite a novel idea. The other thing was that experience is not continuous. It's not a continuum. It's discrete. It occurs in chunks, quanta. And he never got along with Einstein because of this. Einstein was an Aristotelian on things like that, and couldn't be. Well, there's no problem with Heath. It serves to provide a real basis for some future work in physics, in which Sometime soon, we hope to organize an approach to rearrange, at least as a first step, all of the dynamical equations of physics in terms of action, to see if indeed Lagrange made more work for himself by not holding on to the action concept, which was not really known to him as action in those days. They didn't have a name for action. In any case, that's the key part. The event as the chunk of reality that we really have to deal with is that which makes history, not energy. Energy is an abstraction. It's action that makes history. Energy alone is an abstraction. Action can be either an abstraction or an event. So it's the lowest level of an abstraction. I mean, it's the lowest level of an abstraction which can also become experience. Well, the other thing I'd like to comment on before I get started is a sort of a panorama of the phenomena which Spencer Heath is cognizant of in dealing with his experience and knowing. I've already talked about the subjective and objective event idea. The subjective event occurs purely inside the mind, and the objective event occurs purely outside the mind, the self and the not-self. And the interaction between the two is what we call human experience, and that is the subject of knowledge. You cannot have knowledge about anything that can't be experienced. This is at least Heath's idea here. Thinking about the subjective area leads to inspiration, aesthetics, religion, theology, dreams. Those are subjective phenomena, noumena, if I pronounced that correctly. The objective world consists of atoms, waves, stars, molecules, animals, human beings, communities, tribes, and so forth. We learn about these things as they are, and that's called science. That is, a rational understanding about the objective events such as stars and tribes, as they are, is called science. The use of that knowledge, and that's purely dispassionate and non-emotional. It's inspired aesthetically, but that is to take the first step. But the appreciation for it is not emotional. Given this knowledge, though, and combining with human desires and emotions, we have the ingredients of technology. We cause events to happen. We recombine these elements as we have taken them apart in our minds, cause them to happen and make communities, possibly stars, or at least we can duplicate these in vacuum chambers and experiments on the nebulae. We can form protein molecules and getting close to forming cells and so forth. But the point is, the technology is emotional and science is dispassionate. Emotional because there's no action without it. And I'm expressing what I understand about Spencer Heath's ideas, and I think it's grand. As far as calling this epistemology, which I'm inclined to do, Spencer Heath would say, to hell with it. And so I'll read this first item on the philosophy of science. The philosophy of science is a phrase commonly thought to designate a purely quantitative approach, such as is characteristic of the physical and natural sciences. Those who favor it seem willing to omit or neglect all considerations of human and qualitative or emotional values, such as art, religion, morality, spirituality. Those who oppose a philosophy of science base their opposition upon the supposed exclusively quantitative methodology of the natural sciences. In my own view, there is no such thing as special or different kinds of philosophy. Philosophy as such must deal either with feeling or with thought, emotion, or rationality. If it deals with feeling or emotionality, it may be art or it may be religion, but it cannot be philosophy. To be authentic, it must deal with what is known and not merely with what is felt or believed. It must be rational, not emotional. The only knowledge we have that is rational and non-emotional is the knowledge derived from the natural sciences and verified in objective experience. Only on such knowledge, rational knowledge, for its premises, can any rational philosophy be based. Philosophy, therefore, to be rational, must rest upon the discoveries of the physical and natural sciences. Hence, there is no rational or authentic philosophy, but the philosophy of science. Philosophy, by most definitions, must be a form or a mode of understanding, and not a technological procedure. All such procedures involve either feeling or reason. But there is no motivation other than emotional. Without emotion, cold reason may preside, but without emotion, no action follows. The truth about science is that on its research and understanding side, it is prompted by aesthetic motivation, a feeling that order, symmetry, and beauty are to be found. But it does not prejudge its conclusions. On the side of application, however, all of its conclusions are prejudged. They are all, and forgive me if I mispronounce this, desiderata towards which it aims, whether the desire is to create or to destroy. The moment science comes into the field of action, it is wholly emotional in its purpose and intent. Only its methodology is rational. Hence, those supposedly philosophic minds who decry the rationality of science are only looking at one side of it, the side of understanding and method, whether found in nature or adopted by man. The objection to a philosophy of science as being coldly rational depends on disregard of its entire field of human employment, the technological or engineering field. To repeat, philosophy is like science in that it must deal with what is known and understood, and not with what is felt and enjoyed or endured. Since there is no rational knowledge but scientific knowledge, there can be no rational philosophy, in fact, no philosophy at all, apart from religion and art, but the philosophy of science.
Why exclude religion and art?
I don't think he did. That's a good... Let me read that last sentence again, because I'm not sure I understand that. Since there is no rational or authentic... Since there is no rational knowledge, but scientific knowledge, there can be no rational philosophy. In fact, no philosophy at all apart from religion and art, but the philosophy of science. In other words, I think he means by this, there can be a philosophy of religion and art. And there can be a philosophy of science. But he's not aware that there can be any other kind of philosophy. There can be a philosophy which aims at discovering the rationale of aesthetic experience. If it deals with feeling or emotionality, it may be art or it may be religion. But it cannot be philosophy.
Well, then that seems to say that religion and art cannot be philosophy.
That sentence does seem to say that.
It can't be philosophy of science.
Apart from religion.
Well, he says
it can't be philosophy, period, because his definition...
Because there is no other philosophy than that.
Just going to say that many of these things, of course, are simply spontaneous tapings of unprepared just conversation, which this one was.
Sure.
Well, that's consistent with the thing you said yesterday. That philosophy.
Yeah. But if it seems awfully confining and rigid, it wouldn't be like Spencer Heath. And rational and clear, yes, but not dogmatic. So I would look for another interpretation of that last sentence before I would come to the conclusion he was advocating, excluding any other possibilities. he didn't, he preferred to use philosophy attached to science than philosophy, as I was talking about it yesterday. A science of science would sound more like him on general philosophy. Any other comments on that one?
Well, I guess it isn't important to press this at all, but I can't see why, even with his definition of philosophy as a science, that art and quite possibly religion couldn't also be included in his definition. Now, of course, there are some ethereal matters that in which religion or, I'll have to say, quote-unquote, philosophy of religion is maybe involved. But if you take religion as an understanding of the forces of nature and of the universe and of some powers that not yet have been discovered, possibly, that regulate the forces of nature, that is not just an understanding, but a belief and a confidence in these things, then it seems to me that religion and art could very easily be included in his definition of a philosophy of science.
Yes, because what you've described religion to be in that
instance is
what he is describing to be the science of
science.
Exactly. But this isn't, I explained yesterday what he generally meant by religion.
Oh.
If I could find the difference between religion and inspiration in his vocabulary, then I just haven't found it in so much looking.
Well,
it's explicitly stated in various places.
Uh-huh.
But he doesn't make any issues about it. It's just the way he uses it.
Yeah.
Religion and inspiration are the same thing for Spencer Heath.
Okay, and I'll still attach that to inspiration.
Well, philosophy, the way he's using it here, would classify these experiences according to what world of experience they're in.
Yeah.
But it can learn as a philosophy of science. And what I'd prefer to call epistemology, it concentrates on the method of knowledge. And there's only one way that knowledge can be established as knowledge, as rational knowledge. Empirical knowledge is something else. That's what art is about, and I'll read some items on that later. Art has a religious component, obviously. It's positive and negative. I'll read something on this. There's empirical knowledge, which is unique and specific to each individual who has had experience but has not yet put it into a communicable form, which can be communicated or transformed from one mind to another mind to another mind accurately. That's rational knowledge. It has a one-to-one correspondence with reality and thereby with all other minds. Empirical knowledge is specific to each individual who has it. And Michelangelo can paint what he paints, but Michelangelo would have a difficult time even teaching in a lifetime someone else to be able to do what he did. It's specific. And it's born in, it resides with the individual who possesses it. Rational technology, as Heath is talking about here, is rational art. The Paragon propeller, as a rational technology, could be built by, and was ultimately built by, many other companies and many other people. And they didn't have to be such unique and specific as a Michelangelo or a Spencer Heath to be able to master that technology. That distinguishes them as rational technologies. Well, let's try another one of these. All life is experience. All experience is either objective or subjective, factual or fantastic. It is always made up of interactions between an organism or a structure and its environment, the self and the not-self. Or it is composed of interactions among the constituent parts of an organism or structure. Objective experiences modify subjective experiences. Subjective experiences modify objective experiences. This is the science and technology connection again. Objective experiences, as they modify subjective ones, either integrate and maintain the organism or fail to maintain and thus disintegrate the organism. Under objective experience alone, the organism is merely a creature, supine. Subjective experiences, as they influence and modify objective ones, also either integrate and maintain the organism or fail to do so. Subjective experiences, thus, are either functional or dysfunctional. They are also both somatic and psychic, both physiological and psychological. Physiological experience is mainly autonomous. Psychological experience is mainly voluntary and conscious. Yet each is greatly dependent on and modified by the other. Both kinds of structures, both somatic and psychic, are the long accumulations of objective experience, of action by and reaction to environment, involving structures, inorganic and organic, of all degrees of permanency and complexity. And the tendency of the cosmos is predominantly favorable to those organizational forms having primarily the greatest permanency with least complexity, and derivatively, those forms in which both permanency and complexity are most highly achieved. Every specific organism is primarily an abstraction from the general environment. Its whole development has resulted from the action, first, of environment upon it, and second, of its reaction to environment. By this process, consisting of both objective and subjective experiences, the organism, throughout its various forms and transformations, has continued to exist. Lays quite a sound basis, I think, for proceeding on into what is meant by evolution and transcendence, but that I'm going to put off until tomorrow when we start talking about the human species, because of the interactions that that shape the individual are the ones that we're going to want to look at most carefully. I think that I don't know if I'll read this one or not. This is such a nice organization, I think I'll read it. I have it on the list, but I was going to try to jam in some others on you. This is the objective and subjective worlds, and it sounds like it's redundant, but I like the summary of it. This was done in 52, and it's mostly, it's like an outline. It's a series of premises. The objective world is a world of events and of indefinite extent. That's his first premise. And this is the relationship. The subjective world, the mind of man, is evolving out of the objective world. The events constituting the objective world have three and only three quantitative manifestations, measurable in units of mass, motion, and time, and I might add in any combination of those. The proportions of these, their ratios in objective events, constitute the rationale of the objective world. And this is the method. The mind of man is primitively qualitative, feeling, sensing, unique to each mind, and not commensurable one with another. But out of its cosmic origins, the mind of man evolves also rational reactions, super-sensational, definitively quantitative, dimensional. These are common to all minds because inner commensurable. 2 and 2 is 4. And you can tell somebody else that, and he gets the picture. The result, the background substratum of science, as of all else, is the objective world of rational, measurable events. The development of science is the rational apprehension of events as integrations of mass, motion, and time in their respective dimensions and ratios. Scientific technology is the reproportioning of mass, motion, and time in events. The reproportioning. In this, man is no longer a mere creature, but creator, participant with the cosmos in the ordering and determining of events.
That's pretty good.
You make anyone glow to be a technologist. And good at it anyway.
Yeah, but he says that's the background.
That's the result.
Yes, but he's talking about the objective world as the background point.
Oh, yes, it takes place ultimately back in the objective world.
Right, so that what we call science and technology, and this goes back to this other one, the philosophy of science, is in essence dealing with the least important, but it's the only observable.
Yes, it's the only... Only because of it can there be a communicable situation, man to man? Can there be a correspondence between one man and another? Can there be associative? Can there be anything more than molecules or elementary physical phenomena? There couldn't be any higher order of things than an organism, biological organism per se.
I bet he wouldn't say that.
Well, you wait. You can wait and see.
Well, in terms of his discussing science and technology, if he's going to use a word like background to describe science as such in the objective sense, and deals with words like a philosophy must deal with either emotionality or rationality, with what is known, not just felt, with what is known and understood, isn't the dichotomy that's being presented here the fact that by understanding the background, you are no nearer the foreground, but the background exists? And he's not saying what's foreground, but the implication is that these things which we're concerned with are such things as technology and science, the reproportioning, the record of, is only a record of. It is not the nature of anything.
No. The importance of the objective world is the stage for the objectification of this creative process.
But
you don't live there, you interact with it. I would understand it that way.
All right, so the you is the foreground. But what,
it's the stage. Without a stage, it's hard to have a theater.
Yes, my own idea, Carson, in terms of such things as experience and society and science and all that, tend to be, Aristotelian, and I realize as of yesterday we have the combination, let's say Thomas Aquinas was trying to do of these two basic approaches. I guess I'm just hearing my own tape recording.
Tell me more.
Well, I'm just hoping
to get another shot at that. The rationale of the objective world is in the ratios, and these ratios are apprehended by, these are the qualitative features which are not discoverable except by human mind. There's no, physics has no concept of quality as such. That's a purely subjective phenomenon.
What does quality mean?
Well,
are you going to come to that?
I'm going to come to that.
No, okay.
What it means to him is...
I mean to him, yeah.
Yeah. It's in terms of transcendence, and that's... I'll get to that at the end. Worlds within worlds. I'm adding this one. This comes in after concerning the two worlds of experience, which I think is a good one to read, but I'll go on to this one. That's number 858.
That's not on the list here.
That's not on the list. Worlds Within Worlds was the title I gave it. This is a random tape conversation between Spencer McCallum and Spencer Heath, December the 5th, 1955, discussing a Columbia University professor's comments on something or other. Professor Clough. Commented upon the great effort that is being made nowadays to synthesize the sciences, especially to synthesize the physical sciences, the biological sciences, and the social sciences, although he did not speak as though very much headway had been made. Nor do I think he was able to. The difficulty seems to be, in almost everybody's mind, that there is an insurmountable wall between the physical and the biological, the non-living and the living, and between the biological and the social. We don't seem to have discovered any common denominator between those three fields. The approach that is made in socionomy, which is his term and his conception for social science.
Socionomy
is the word Spencer Heath liked to use, and I'll read an article, an item on that, in which he explains his preference for that label. The approach that is made in socionomy seems to supply that deficiency. Socionomy being the name Spencer Heath gave for his system of inquiry. Because it discovers that each succeeding level contains all that is in the level below it. That is to say that all that is in the physical realm is included in the biological. The same atoms, the same forces, the same time units, the same rhythms that there is in the physical realm. And in addition, what is unique to the biological realm is that it has a system of organization different from the other, chiefly, if not exclusively, in the fact that its unit is not the quantum of Planck, the least magnitude of event. Its unit at the biological level is what is known as the biological cell, all of which are fundamentally alike, and all living structures are regarded as being organizations of those cells in various forms. Ascending still higher, we find that at the social level, the unit there corresponding with the Planckian unit and with the biological unit, the unit there is the indivisible individual. And all social phenomena and events are made up of more or less complex organizations and interactivities of these individual units, notwithstanding that they contain all that is in the two levels below them. They contain the same atoms, the same biological cells, and the same in kind and principle, in addition, that is distinctively human and social, the same kind of imagination, and so forth. There are three worlds there. There is the physical world in which no animal is found. There is the animal world in which the complete physical world is found. And there is the human world in which alone the social phenomenon is found, yet all three of these, the physical, the biological, and the social, are united with the common denominator that each is founded upon a unit. Each unit is a multiple of its preceding unit or units, and each organizes its units in fundamentally the same manner that the unit is organized at either of the other two levels. That is the common denominator which breaks the dilemma in which nearly all thinkers find themselves who are frustrated at the apparent inability to bridge the gap between the physical, the biological, and between the biological and the social. My idea on the similarity of organization is that they are combining, to the degree that they're organized at all, it's symbiotic. Is that the right word? They are harmonious. You get chemical compounds, organizations of atoms, only when you find atoms which are compatible with each other in that sort of chemical framework. Cells, likewise. And human beings, likewise, in communities.
This three worlds, somehow or other, I missed. Could you, can I ask you to go back?
Yes, of course.
On the, there are three worlds on the other page.
There are three worlds there.
Yes.
There's the physical world in which no animal is found.
Wait, now what does that mean?
That means to the degree it's purely physical, there is no...
Animals are not physical?
Look, he's now saying at the bottom, maybe my little picture of this would help. Consider a circle here. And everything in it is called the universe. That encompasses all things, the whole cosmos. It's just a circle I'm going to make here for illustrative purposes. Everything in that is physical.
You might say the inorganic.
The inorganic. It is not reproductive of its own kind.
I've got it. Okay. That's where I'm
And then... Inside of this, there is everything.
Yeah.
Of all the things in there, some of it, and I'll draw another much smaller circle, everything in that one is not only physical, but it's also biological. It has a reproductive capacity to it. And then inside of that one, the smaller one, there's a yet smaller one, and everything in that one is volitional or social.
Yeah.
It's not only physical, but it's also organic, and it's also volitional.
Yeah. So wouldn't you reverse that, Al?
Hmm?
Wouldn't you reverse that? That in the center is the physical core?
Well, it's not a core.
Well, in the center...
It's like a pyramid with the volitional at the peak.
It's a cone, really. And when he's showing these concentric circles, you're looking at the cone straight toward you. Now set the cone up on space, and the organic, the volitional at the peak of evolution, perhaps, you might say.
Yeah, because when you're talking about circles within, it would seem that the ever-expanding one is on the outside, which is not the physical.
I didn't say anything about expansion. It's a logical construct.
You use circles for the universe, and that did it to you.
Well, that's a...
Well, I was going to say that there are... I'm sure you realize that there are... It's a tough problem to try to explain this kind of a thing with the geometric forms.
It sure is.
And
I'm not, this is a common technique used in logic with syllogistic reasoning. If one of those circles crosses the other one, you have violated a premise someplace. Mm-hmm.
What he's really saying is, is this correct, that there are these three things, one which we might call A, one which is A plus B, and one which is A plus B plus C.
Exactly. That's great. I understand that to be exactly what he's getting at here.
With nothing after the equal, which would follow that, because that's unlimited?
Well, that's the whole. A plus B plus C is everything.
Yeah, that would... Or A plus A and A plus B and A plus B plus C is everything.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Well, I take that back. That's everything in the objective world.
Mm-hmm. But there's no
But
way
everything to, has to no. include also the aesthetic and inspirational.
There's
and
no way of
the spiritual part. Eli makes plenty of room for that. I've already talked about the two worlds of experience, objective and subjective. This is about the objective. There are three parts to it.
What about the apparent hints, at least, of the possibility of developing cells from chemical compounds?
How would it relate to this?
Yeah.
Well, the volitional, all technology is volitional to the degree that there is the pinnacle there, the A plus B plus C. Then the biological world might be expanded to the dictates of human desires, and not simply left to the occurrence of these events as they would ordinarily occur, as they have always occurred. Human will can...
Well, we know that the world is every day becoming more organic, and the world is every day becoming more human. Qualitative.
Spencer Heath doesn't say anything that would lead me to believe that he thought these worlds were fixed in size. On the contrary.
No, I understand that.
Or proportion.
But I don't understand, and I don't think anybody else does, but at least I'll throw it out, that if the cell is in some way, a combination of elements, what point and how does the cell, how does the amoeba that Ardrey talks about know enough to go in one direction for if it's trained this way? And he says it does.
From its subjectivity.
All right. Now, this
inherited
is a cell.
Memory, yes.
See, this is a cell. But what about a dram of gooey and a little pinch of something else, and all of a sudden you've got a cell. Now, at what point do you interject into this cell this volitional, this subjective element? And how?
Well, it seems it seems to me that if it's not in this paper, but if Heath's idea of organic subjectivity is valid, then the cell produced in a test tube from purely inorganic elements, and that seems to be a possibility, supposing it were. And to reconcile this with the idea of organic subjectivity, it simply would not have inherited that experience.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some evidence now that that experience or memory of experience from previous generations is inherited to some extent.
Yeah, but if it's inherited, it means that it had to get there in the first place.
Yes, and so that such a cell would be at a great disadvantage, presumably.
How do we know?
How do we know that it would be at a disadvantage?
Yeah.
Well, if the inherited subjectivity is advantageous, and I think that it is.
Yeah, but you're going one step. You're missing a step. Suppose that all cells were originally formed in this manner.
All right.
They had to have the whatever it is, the genes within the cell. To pass on to future generations of cells the inheritance, you see, and at some point in the structure of the cell from elements. I'm not denying God in this. I'm not denying the laws of nature. I'm simply saying that possibly man might be able to combine the elements in such a way that at the same time there is some natural force. I don't know. I'm not a scientist that could give it a shot of inheritance, you see.